What needs to be done, and done now, to shore up our hospitals for when we open up our borders and presumably stop having lockdowns? The government has indicated a change of direction in how we respond to COVID-19, moving from lockdowns to relying more on the health system. In such a scenario, experts are warning hospitals will see a higher number of COVID patients. I'm joined by specialist emergency physician and president of the Australasian College of Emergency Medicine, Dr. John Bonning, who says we can't stay locked down forever and urgently need to consider a spectrum of alternatives to bolster our health system, from more dedicated COVID wards to hospitalisation at home. Also joining us will be Kate Weston from the Nurses Organisation, who says any moves away from a lockdown system would need to be approached cautiously to avoid overwhelming the health system. First is COVID modeller and Professor of Physics at the University of Auckland, Sean Hendy, to explain what numbers our health system should be anticipating. Tēnā koe, Sean.
Tēnā koe.
There's an awful lot of talk at the moment about a vaccination benchmark. What should the aim be percentage-wise? 80% or more than that before we consider reopening the borders, do you think?
Look, even 80% would create some massive challenges for our healthcare system. You know, the Pfizer vaccine is very good. It's one of the best, and it is very good at preventing severe disease. It's not as good as at preventing transmission. So it still allows you can be double vaccinated. And you can still get the virus and pass it on to other people, even if you're protected from severe disease. And then there is enough people who would either be potentially unvaccinated at 80% or just are unlucky with the protection that they've got from the vaccine, a small number, that at 80%, you'd still see potentially thousands of fatalities in a year and many, many more people requiring hospitalisation. So we really need to be ambitious with our vaccination targets. We need to be aiming more at 90% in order to really get back to normal. I mean, there are other things you can do. You know, obviously we've been using lockdowns over the last 18 months to deal with outbreaks. So, you know, the higher our vaccination rates, the more effective lockdowns become and the shorter period of time that they may need to be imposed. And maybe they could be less stringent. So that is an option. But also we could you know, make sure we keep some of the measures in place for the coming years that we have been using, you know, such as encouraging widespread mask use, making sure that we're scanning, you know, maybe considering event size restrictions, you know, possibly during winter months when we'll be more at risk. And so those sort of measures might have to be kept in place for the medium to long term. And that they can also help reduce impact on the health system and reduce mortality.
Have you done any modelling, taking the case scenario, say we're vaccinated at 90% and there are restrictions on people who are allowed in terms of vaccination proof and antigen testing, for example? What scenario do you see as likely?
Yeah, look, I mean, what you want to achieve is population immunity. I mean, that's the ideal. And that's really where you've got enough measures in place, you've got enough vaccination so that the virus really won't spread. You'll still get cases, people will still bring it in from overseas. They may pass it on to a few other people, but you don't get these sort of big outbreaks that we're dealing with in Tamaki Makaurau right now. And so that would be what we would want to aim for. That would be the ideal. And yeah, that involves vaccination rates up over 90% for the population, and that includes you know, children over five, which we'll be learning about the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine for over fives for the Pfizer vaccine shortly. So we'd have widespread coverage. We'd keep some measures in place. We'd probably still have to have some border controls, but they could be a lot lighter than they are now. So maybe a home isolation rather than full MIQ. If you come from a lower or medium risk country, we may still have to keep MIQ for people coming from high risk countries where spread is much more extensive.
Is it likely that if we don't hit a high enough vaccination rate that we will have more COVID deaths here?
Yes. Look, that's, I think, a given if we can't push that vaccination rate up high enough. I mean, even then, we will still, from time to time, have deaths. I mean, I guess the goal would be to still try and keep those to a minimum, because, you know, there's not much margin for error with COVID. You know, you either keep those deaths down relatively low, or you find yourself overwhelmed. You know, the Delta variant has really changed the game. It is much more transmissible, much more difficult to handle, and when it gets into a community, even if that community has a relatively high vaccination rate, and I guess we're seeing that overseas, where countries that perhaps had vaccinated their way out of the waves that they were facing last winter, you know, with the Alpha variant, and now, you know, back in trouble with the Delta variant. So it remains a threat, even at that 80% vaccination rate.
Sean, getting questions in from the listeners, and this does make sense. Are we talking about 90% of the total population or of the over 12s?
We would want to get 90% of the over 5s. I mean, that would be the ideal. It's difficult, you know, the lower that percentage across the entire population, the more restrictions and measures we'll have to put in place. So ideally, we would like something like 90% of the over fives vaccinated.
Do you imagine that it would make sense for us to bolster our health system in anticipation of the borders reopening?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's essential. I mean, you know, we know that we do have an underfunded health system as it stands that struggles in the winter to deal with seasonal influenza. This is just going to put more burden on that health system. And even when we get, you know, if we achieve that 90% on average across the population, there'll still be parts of our population where we don't. For whatever reason, they don't hit that average, and they would still remain vulnerable. So although, you know, 90% will give us a lot of protection, you know, we still may have parts of the population where we could have an outbreak from time to time that would put a burden on that health system. It's quite possible it would come in winter, a similar time to seasonal influenza. And so we know our healthcare system already struggles. So certainly I think putting some resources into bolstering the healthcare system would be smart.
Sean, are there any lessons to be learned from the current outbreak?
Look, we've seen that it spreads very rapidly. I mean, we're not an exception. We saw that rapid spread. It's been a large outbreak. We saw a very big super spreading event at the Assembly of God Church, and so, you know, certainly we've seen here similar things that have happened overseas. So we're not going to be an exception to Delta. I think also it just illustrates the strain that it can put on our contact tracing system. You know, the enormous number of contacts that have had to be traced coming out of this outbreak just shows that relying solely on contact tracing, you know, while our contact tracers have done an amazing job in controlling this outbreak, you know, we can't put all our eggs in that basket.
Thank you so much. That's Professor Sean Hendy. With us now, Australian College for Emergency Medicine President Dr. John Bonning. Good morning, John.
Morning, Ellen.
How ready are our hospitals for an influx of COVID patients if and when the borders open, or when the borders open? Because the impression we get with this current outbreak is that they have scrambled, even with, what, a few dozen hospitalisations.
Yes, so we did get up to speed very rapidly this time, having, you know, been prepared March, April of last year, and then going through that relatively quiescent phase, and then rapidly switched things on. Because, of course, we went from one case to 1,000 cases over a matter of a few weeks. It spread so rapidly. So, and the health system, you'll have heard reports, and we have been under duress and stress in recent times, months, years even. And so, you know, we will cope, but we need to do so some planning, some work on infrastructure, staffing and what have you for the next stage.
So are we talking about planning for that now in terms of what extra intensive care beds, dedicated COVID wards, what at the minimum do we need?
So there's a spectrum of disease and we need to look at it across the community. So yeah, we'll have seen some explicit modelling on the number of intensive care beds that are required. But that is the tip of the iceberg. Experience from overseas has shown that around 2.5% of patients with COVID end up in intensive care and they're very sick. And that's very, very important. But of course, there's a huge a number of patients that are less sick. And you could expect perhaps 20% of patients with COVID to end up contacting the hospital, coming to emergency departments and potentially requiring admission. So that's significant numbers. And then there's a large number that do need some monitoring and care in the community as well. And we've talked about things like hospital in the home, patients with oxygen saturation probes at home, managing at home, and then trying to predict who's going to get worse. So there's this whole spectrum of disease. And yes, we are doing some significant planning around that at the moment.
And investment? I mean, planning's one thing. Do you have the money for it? Because the thing is that we know that so many of our hospitals were already run down and under-resourced.
Yes, so the system was under pressure. And you know, the other thing that this brings, of course, is there's a little bit of a reduction of the business as usual that's done, and presentations to emergency departments have dropped across the country a wee bit, but a lot of that will represent unmet healthcare need that is required later. And for example, when I was meeting with my UK counterparts last week, they've now got 5 million people on their waiting list waiting for healthcare. So yes, it will put the health system under significant duress. That's why any talk of movement into a mitigation phase, mitigation of the effects, must have strong vaccination levels, and we've heard about that, and some planning about what we're going to do about the structure of the hospitals to deal with these patients and staffing. So protection of, you know, so PPE, for example, but a lot of some building changes, negative pressure rooms, closing off cubicles with, you know, perspex or glass as opposed to curtains, etc. So yes, there needs to be some investment.
What about unique purpose-built facilities? Would that be the ideal?
Yes, unfortunately not. So patients don't come in with the diagnosis tattooed on their forehead, and they've always got plenty of other, what we call comorbidities, other illnesses as well. As we've heard, those that are affected by the virus are overwhelmingly the unvaccinated, and quite significantly, those with other illnesses. So diabetes, heart failure, chronic conditions. And so, you have to see them in a health facility. And we can't build a purpose-built hospital for these patients because they'll have come into the main hospital anywhere. We haven't got the staff for it. We haven't, not like the, I believe the Chinese were able to put up, you know, purpose-built hospitals in a matter of weeks or months. That certainly isn't going to happen here. So we have to deal with it within our existing infrastructure, but there's got to be some planning. And as I said, the community dealing with this is something that's going to require a lot of work. So we're working with our partners in general practice and urgent care as to how these people might be looked after in the community, because there's a significantly higher number that will be managed in the community.
Well, describe for us, what does hospital at home look like?
So again, these are patients that don't require oxygen or higher levels of care. They'll be unwell. They'll have this nasty COVID flu, if you like, but they'll need people to be monitoring them. So oxygen saturation monitors and try to predict who's going to get sicker. And of course, you know, we know Delta goes right through households when it gets in there, and Delta finds the unvaccinated. So children, here's another issue that's been raised in New South Wales. Children get the illness, but usually don't get very sick with it. But it's become a bit of a social issue over there because the children then require care because their parents, their caregivers are sick and often in hospital. So that's something that we need to look at. Again, COVID often finds those that are socially and economically marginalised. So this is care in the home and working out when that person needs to go to hospital, how they might get to hospital, and trying to manage people in the community as well as you possibly can. Because another unfortunate statistic from the UK is that of those hospitalised with COVID, 25% of them caught COVID in hospital. So this is, from the last 18 months experience in the UK. So we've got to be scrupulous about infection control measures, use of PPE, and trying to keep people out of hospital.
Well, this is the thing we're going to move to now. We're talking to the nurses in a moment. But how can we better protect our nurses and our doctors, our healthcare staff?
Look, this may be seen to be controversial. Personally, I don't necessarily think it is. I strongly believe that we need to make it mandatory for all healthcare workers to be vaccinated. This has occurred across the ditch in Australia in most jurisdictions. I think Victoria hasn't quite yet, but New South Wales, Queensland, WA, all those other jurisdictions have. So that is a really, really good way of protecting our healthcare workforce. Then there's got to be guidelines and protocols in terms of how you deal with such patients. And we know that patients come into hospital with non-specific symptoms and end up being COVID positive. We've seen that up in counties Manukau. So we need to have PPE for all interactions, and it's quite cumbersome to do that. Good use of PPE and clear guidelines and ways of putting it on, taking it off. That's quite a high-risk procedure as well. So staff training, physical structure of hospitals, there's lots of things that need to be done. We are doing that at the moment, and we're doing some planning. But there's more work that needs to be done before we start to open up.
Thank you, John. Stay with us, if you would. Kate Weston is the Acting Nursing and Professional Services Manager for the New Zealand Nurses Organisation. Kia ora, Kate.
Kia ora.
Let's pick up that last point that John made. All healthcare workers should be vaccinated. Have the nurses been talking about this and making it compulsory?
There has been some conversations, certainly. The Nursing Council came out a couple of weeks ago with a statement around a professional responsibility for vaccination. The conversation around making it mandatory is certainly one that needs to be approached and discussed with the wider healthcare unions and professional associations about what that would mean, and ensuring that the workforce is protected. But there are some groups still within the workforce who have got hesitancy or reluctance. So really working alongside of those individuals, both industrially and professionally, about supporting decisions around vaccination.
If we do change tack and move from relying on lockdowns to relying on the health system, it seems pretty much inevitable eventually. What are your concerns for nursing staff?
So the nursing staff have been under considerable duress, as has been already mentioned, the healthcare system, but particularly for the nursing workforce. We've gone through a couple of years of really intense pressure with COVID last year, RSV this year, COVID again, but that's against a backdrop of what has been an underfunded, underinvested model where nursing has really been a casualty. We're running at the moment the highest vacancies across the country that we've ever had, and that puts us in a position of really being understaffed to be able to manage. So what needs to be addressed as part of the whole of system approach is absolutely investing and bolstering the nursing workforce to ensure that they're in a position to be able to support any efforts around COVID management in the future, particularly if we're looking at different models.
We have some pinch points, Kate, don't we? I mean, particularly it's been made clear we don't have enough trained ICU nurses. I mean, there were ICU nurses going to Tamaki Makaurau from other parts of the country to help out.
There were, but I think the point also needs to be that it's not only about the small percentage of ICU admissions. If we're talking hospital in the home, then that's going to have a high reliance on the nursing workforce as well, because that's exactly the workforce that you would expect to be able to monitor people as district nursing does already in their homes. And we're working with a workforce that, unfortunately, at the moment, we don't have the numbers that we need. It's been coming at us like a slow motion train wreck, really, that the amount of nurses that we need to meet demand isn't there. So some very, very intensive work needs to be done to support and bolster the nursing workforce to be able to be as responsive as we're going to need to be at such time as vaccination rates are high enough to safely consider moving away from the current lockdown model that we've experienced over the past 18 months.
So staffing, do you think, is really the priority in terms of planning for the reopening of the borders?
It's one of the priorities. I think the previous speakers have identified it's not only about the staffing, you need to have the adequate facilities. There are a number of things that need to be done with lessons learned in a timely way from what we've experienced previously in 2020, what we're experiencing now, and going forward into what is going to look like a different model of working that is going to support the entire community to be safe. One of the concerns that we have, and the previous speakers have noted it, is that once you've gone through COVID and you're in a recovery mode, which we still were really before it came again, like another wave crashing, is that we need to be able to manage the surge of those other people who couldn't access healthcare. So it's not only about the people who have had or experienced COVID, but it's about the people who couldn't access healthcare, or they then become more unwell often while they're waiting. So that's another thing that needs to be put in the mix.
Would you see any advantage to that idea I was discussing with John Bonning about having specific facilities built for COVID patients?
It's still going to put pressure on the workforce. It's just changing it. So we've already seen that with the emergence of the MIQs, that we've got a fixed and finite pool of nursing availability in Aotearoa currently. And we've taken a top slice and we've put some into MIQs, we've put some into vaccination and testing. And it's actually taken from one area to bolster another. And another situation we need to consider is aged residential care, primary care. There's only so many nurses to go around, and we need to be using them as a workforce who are going to be able to make a real difference in COVID management going into the future, whatever that looks like.
Okay, just to wrap this up, do you have a percentage of nurses who have been vaccinated at this stage?
Nurses are doing really well. They actually don't have an exact percentage for you, but there has been very good uptake on the whole from our nursing workforce.
That's Kate Weston, thank you, from the Nurses Organisation, also talking to Dr. John Bonner.